All right, everybody. I am here today with Big John Evans. I don't know if that nickname's going to stick. We'll see if he kills me later. I will warn everybody just a little bit. I have bounced from here in Omaha, which was like 30 degrees when we left, to Texas, New Mexico, which was about 80. And now we're back here, which is 20. I got a little in the back of my throat. I will try to mute the mic if I have to clear my throat. But I do have just a little bit of a tickle, and I apologize to everybody. John A., thanks for being on here. Appreciate it. I just finished up Exodelic today. I do want to let you know, even though you sent me the copy so I could read it, you did get a sale out of it because, as always, when I go on vacation with my wife, I don't have any time to read. So I ended up getting the audiobook so that I could listen to it when I was falling asleep. Appreciated that, but that was really, really nice. For the people who have not run across you before, though, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing. I am originally Canadian, although I live in California these days, kind of shuttle back and forth, depending on the whims and the weather and so forth. I started writing when I was very, very young, got an engineering degree in school, and signed my first book deal when I was 30 years old, writing mostly thrillers set in faraway locations, partly on the grounds that it made travel tax deductible, and I was very eager to travel the world at the time. But science fiction was my first love. I grew up reading it. At one point, I had read the vast majority of all Hugo nominees, not just winners. So Exodelic, which came out a couple of years ago, is my first actual outright bona fide genre science fiction novel. I'm particularly excited about it for that reason.
And if anybody doesn't know, the paperback actually drops today, so it is available in paperback now, too. So if you missed your turn for the hardcover, which would make you know a nice, beautiful trophy on your shelf, the paperback is available. You kind of answered my second question, would be kind of what is your villain origin story? Sounds like you've always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah, it's a good two-phase. I mean, one, yes, I was born into villainy. I grew up in a house with bookstores and with bookshelves in every room. Was, you know, reading at a young age, and I think I read my first short story when I was 8 years old. It was very derivative and not very good looking back, but, you know, the ambition was there. But the second part was after I graduated, I did spend some time bouncing around, working and traveling. And while I was working, I was writing very bad early juvenile novels. And at one point I realized, hey, they say you should write about what you know, but why don't I start writing about the places I'm traveling to and from and add some kind of plot line on top of that. So I think airline tickets were sort of my ticket to supervillainy as well.
Which I think answers another question. I was going to say, I saw it on your bio. I was going to ask you what semi-pro traveler meant, but I think that's what you mean.
Yes. Yeah, mostly writing. A little bit of journalism here and there, but mostly fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, you can only take that write what you know so far because most people haven't slain a dragon or hopefully I'd get a little worried about some of those murder mystery writers as well. It's like, yeah, you don't always have to write what you know. So also another question I have for you then for the aspiring artists, writers, things like that out there, I've got a two-part question. First part, and we'll take them one at a time so you don't have to remember everything I asked. What does a day in the life of John Evans look like?
It varies a lot depending on whether I am writing prose full-time or writing fiction full-time or doing neither. Most of my books have been written full-time. So when I'm writing, I sort of wake up, force myself to write 1,000 words over coffee, take most of the rest of the day relatively down as recharge time, wander around, catch up with friends, that sort of thing, write another 1,000 words at night. So I'm pretty rigorous and quantitative about it, 2,000 words a day most days. When I'm writing full-time. Exodelic was actually not written full-time. It was written in bits and pieces when the muse hit me or when a notion came along. And that is very different. That is wake up, work on the job. At the time I was running this archive program. These days I'm writing software. And on an evening or a weekend, find my mind slightly invaded by some new strange invader and try and exercise it by putting it on the page.
Gotcha. So you're going to start hanging out with Paul Jessup. He's a horror author, also does a little programming on the side there. And by on the side, I mean, that's his day job. and then second of all, if you had a young aspiring author in front of you and you're either teaching a class or they just wanted a piece of advice to maybe get them started or smooth out a piece of the career path that maybe they didn't know about, what would be your little piece of advice to them, or what would you talk to them about?
Mine would be to stubbornly keep cranking work out. Gene Wolfe has this great bit about how people think a novel is a lot and a big deal, but if you write just one page a day, every day for a year, and at the end of the year, you have a 365-page novel. A friend of mine has what he calls the Rolling Stones rule, which is if you release enough material, some of it will be good. Which a little unfair on the Rolling Stones, I think, but he's got a point. But more generally, the more you do, the better you do. You know, Gary Player, another quote, the more I practice, the luckier I get. And that goes for writing as well as sports.
Yeah, fair enough. Most of the really good musicians didn't just, you know, do it the first time.
Yeah.
I did one lesson. Unless you're Groundhog Day, but that's besides the point.
There are always exceptions. There's always the Sex Pistols, but not everyone can be the Sex Pistols.
No. Anyhow, we could get a morbid topic going on that bro. One thing I had to say, and I'm going to tell you this about Exodelic. Anybody who's starting this, you get in that first couple of chapters, and it's very person of interest or eagle eye, if anybody's seen those shows. You know, just kind of that AI in the background doing the stuff. And then I feel like you sat there and said, okay, this is a very, you know, espionage type, you know, thriller type thing. And they're like, and then the part of you who's really into that sci-fi thing said, you know, hold on, somebody hold my beer. Because then we go a little crazy. This book takes off after those first couple of chapters, and you're like, okay, I'm not sure what I'm reading anymore. I mean, let's face it, you've got, and this is not spoiler stuff, first couple chapters. I avoid spoilers like the plague, even on a book that's been out for a while. But, you know, we've got bullets that, you know, somebody's just, they're immune. You know, it goes through, leaves a hole in their shirt, doesn't bounce off them, leaves a hole in the back of their shirt. No explanation. We've got teleportation. We've got, and this is going in early, so again, I'm not going to spoil with you what it actually is, but we've got this question towards the beginning is there multiverse? Is there time travel? Is there, you know, you don't know what you're getting. And I actually just finished that up today. I finished up that book. So again, I do know what's going on. But I feel like you did such a good job. Every time we turn around and we think we know what's going on, and this doesn't happen in the sci-fi genre a lot, I feel like you've got another like, and you thought you knew where I was going with that. How long did it take you to write this book?
A while. I mean, most of my books I've written in sort of brief, intense stints of 2 or 3 months. Exodelic took a year and a half, all told. And yeah, there was a very conscious design on my part to, on a semi-regular basis, pull the rug out from under the reader and sort of talk about the, you know, whenever you're reading a book, you sort of have a conversation with going on, like, this is the kind of book I'm reading, this is how I respond to it, and deliberately subvert that and escalate and change that on a semi-regular basis, which, you know, not everyone loves, and I appreciate that, but I have always really enjoyed books that do that.
I feel like if you don't have that twist here and there, you've got to write a really, really, really solid book to not bore the reader. I personally appreciate the twists and turns every once in a while. I think you likened, what did you say about, you know what, I had it up here. Something about Philip K. Dick meets, is it Neal Stephenson? Is that how the thing was on you? Yeah.
That's someone at Tor said that, and I appreciated it.
Yes. I got you.
They're both favorites of my own, so yeah.
Yeah, I felt like there was a little Neo in there too, and that's about as far as I'm going to go down that topic. But with that whole thing, and again, I'm not going to go into specifics here, but whether it was like the multiverse or the time travel or whatever the reader ends up finding out it is, and I asked the same thing of, SRB, Sarah Rees Brennan. My mind dumped a minute. She recently had written a book where a character had gone into a book in the story and then found out that other people had gone into the book in the story. So, of course, every time somebody goes into the book changes. And, of course, then you have to have, what was the original book? What was the book that when this person was done with it? What was the book when this person? Did you have to do the same thing with Exodelic? Did you have to have, okay, this is the story, and this is how it would have played out until this person enters the story at this point in the story, and then this happens? Because you have that happen a couple of times. And did you have to have multiple ones in your head, or did you just kind of turn on a dime?
No, I definitely had multiple ones in my head. Even if I knew I wasn't going to write them, you know, I couldn't help but extrapolate. And I think it's, you know, once you start telling a story, or, you know, any given book has or movie has a main story, and then you have, you know, other characters who wander on. And one of my favorite approaches is when some other person wanders on stage and you realize this isn't their story, but they also have a story, which they are the main character, and we're intersecting with them at this particular moment, and they're going to move on. So, I mean, independent of the kind of book and whether it's a rug pulling kind of book, I really like that approach where it feels like everyone has a story of equal importance and vividness going on. And I'm always having in the back of my mind what happened to them after they go off the page. Even in my early books, you know, the minor characters who, you know, a shopkeeper who shows up for a chapter or two, I have some vague idea what happens to them the next year or so.
And I think you even alluded to that. And her name just jumped out of my head. I think this is what happens when I do the audiobooks too much. His girlfriend at the end. Oh, what's her name?
Clara.
Oh, I knew it began with a C. It was driving me crazy. But she has a line in there towards the end about something along that even she was happy to do this because she finally felt like she was in her own adventure or something along that lines. So I can really see that coming out in your work as well.
And I do think a lot of people have periods in their lives where they feel like they're the protagonist of what's happening to them, and periods of their lives where they feel like they're not, that life is happening to them and they're not sort of captaining their way through it. And I think people can respond to both of those situations.
And again, I won't go into specifics here on certain things, but I love the fact that you've basically written characters that are from almost different time frames in the cosmos. And so you're also dealing with the fact that people have different expectations based on when in history they're from. And so I really like that, you know, the clashes is like, okay, you're saying this, but oh crud, maybe they don't know what that means, or maybe they don't know what this expectation was. Did you find it difficult to keep all of that straight because of the fact that some of your characters weren't all from the same area, and keeping track of who was expected to know how to act in different situations?
Mostly, I think I had that pretty much intuitive, largely because, you know, when you travel a lot, mores and standards, you know, vary a lot geographically as well. And behavior that's acceptable in San Francisco is very different from behavior that's acceptable in Cairo, for instance. And you know, so you sort of keep track of that. It's also, I will follow you in refraining from too many spoilers, but there is a section of the book that alludes to a very far future. And I've always been a little irritated by how much like our present far futures tend to be. So on the one hand, I knew I wanted to make it as alien as possible, but on the other hand, there were plot reasons to make it similar to our own, which I won't get into too much detail on, but I wanted to sort of have a little explanation on the side, or some subtle hinting on the side of why that might be the case.
Yeah, I did love the parts, especially where our erstwhile protagonist is trying to explain something about where they're from. And of course I can almost tell you trying not to name names or say anything specific, but you're like, well, you know, it's not all good. but I appreciated that. I also love some of the characters that you brought in. There's a lot of characters that are people from history, that especially like the L. Ron Hubbard stuff, and you've had some other things in there where you kind of have like these little Easter eggs where people can tell maybe what some of the stuff you've read in the past and where you've gotten some of your stuff from, but also political figures, things like that. I always love the ones where they don't try to shove an alternate history on there, but you kind of mention people in the background. Like, I don't think this one's going to be a huge spoiler for anybody, but like, again, he meets Barack Obama because of what's happening. And it's a situation where this is a person that would never meet Barack Obama in a normal circumstances.
And you mentioned Hubbard. I won't say who else is involved there, but that's also very science fictional. There is actually one of the members of that household was a sort of seminal science fiction fan who wrote about it for science fiction fanzines. And long before he ever bought the book, Patrick Nielsen Hayden of Tor.com, I was mentioning on the internet that I was mildly obsessed with this particular 1930s, 1940s, 1950s household, found a copied version of this Alva Rogers essay from the 1940s and 50s of like what it was like to live in the strangest house in Los Angeles in that time and sent me a copy. So it's a nod not just to history, but to science fiction history, which I appreciate.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, I can't imagine, knowing what we know about that whole situation now, I can't imagine going through it at the time.
Yeah.
I just have a feeling there were some people in his life who are like, nope, that didn't surprise me at all. So what gave you, without going into too much specifics, but what kind of gave you the idea for this story? Because, again, the story where you think you're going in the first couple chapters is not the story that you're in at the middle of it. And that's not even the story that by the time you get to the end of it, again, spoiler reverse here, because I want people to read the book. But, you know, I feel like you had multiple different things that maybe brought this idea to you.
Yeah, there were a couple of different scenes. Although another thing that dropped in is, as I mentioned, you know, science fiction was my first love. I was a pretty completist on science fiction through my 30s and still read a lot of it. And this is my first science fiction novel. So there is a certain aspect of I'm going to write the everything and the kitchen sink or a science fiction novel with all the aspects and all the tropes. I didn't go that far, but I was sort of leaned to my motto when writing this book was constantly, when in doubt, more. This is not a minimalist book. This is a big, sweeping book. At the time when I started writing it, I was directing this very weird program, the GitHub Archive program. Which is archiving the world's open source software with a bunch of partners and so forth, but most cinematically beneath an Arctic mountain in Svalbard on archival film built to last for 1,000 years. So somewhere in the north, you know, if civilization collapses for whatever reason, all of our open source software is up there on film, ready to be queued up again once we get computers rolling again. It's an interesting time capsule, you know, and snapshot of what was going on in 2020. But also meant that as part of my job, wondering about what things were going to be like in 1,000 years was, you know, billable time. So I contemplated that a fair amount. And also, I keep a pretty close ear to the ground in the tech industry. And this obscure little company, nonprofit really, called OpenAI, had just dropped this thing called GPT-2, which didn't get that much attention. What did get attention is that previously they'd been an open source, open software company. And again, that was the world I was in. And they decided they weren't going to fully release GPT-2 because they thought it was too dangerous to the world. And that, as you might imagine, did get a fair amount of attention. Fast forward, here we are today. They're one of the biggest, most controversial, most melodramatic companies in the world. But at the time, you know, they're fairly obscure. So the combination of what if AI starts really taking off in a disconcerting way? And what if it found some really weird stuff when it did get smarter than us? Plus, what is the world going to be like in 1,000 years? 1,000 years is an extremely long time, very difficult to forecast. Yeah. Those combinations, those two seeds kind of crystallized into the book.
Forget 1,000 years. I try to explain to my kids that, you know, there was no internet when I was a kid. You know,
right? Like we are someone that has the foot on the accelerator.
I joke with my daughter because she's just barely old enough. It's like, you're older than Google. Not by much, but she is.
I was talking to a friend the other day about how many people are going to remember what the floppy disk icon they use for saving things actually means, and, you know, how that number's diminished.
Oh, yeah. It was like, I don't know if it was a joke or not, but I know there's something going around where some kids like, hey, you 3D printed the save icon because somebody had a floppy disk. Again, I don't know if that was made up, but. So like the joke is like, how many kids these days know, like, you sound like a broken record. It's like, what the heck's a broken record sound like?
All right. One little anecdote, like 5 years ago, my wife and I were walking along Venice Boardwalk in Venice, California. Mm-hmm. And this guy had his copies of his album on CD and he was trying to give them out to people. You know, he was a hustler drumming up interest in his band, fair enough. Mm-hmm. And these two teenage Europeans, they were like 15 and 16 sisters, I think. He approached them and they're looking at them like, what is this strange disc-like mirror that you are waving in our faces? We have no concept of a compact disc. What is this thing? So, yeah.
I mean, they don't. I mean, you just download it. I mean, heck, I'm techy enough that like all of my iTunes and stuff like that, it's all on my phone. I haven't bought a CD in years. So
I probably have a CD here somewhere, but I have no way to play it. So it's sort of a moot point.
That's true too. Yeah, even the computers don't come with CD players anymore. I mean, I thought it was big when they finally switched to the flash drive because, I mean, floppy disks. All the improvements you think about in computing, and this is still semi-adjacent because of what your story is about, all the big things we changed, and like the floppy disk was the last thing to change. It's like you still had a stupid little floppy disk to boot up files and stuff if you needed to get into your computer sometimes. But the flash drive finally came along and replaced that.
I mean, I think it's more than adjacent because like our world and the way we interact, the world is more and more software, right? And the world being software, you know, if you go from metaphor to actuality, it's a pretty small jump, actually, or smaller than it used to be. So.
And I did love, and of course, this is spoiler adjacent, so I'm only going to go so far with this. But you have situations in this story where people need to do stuff with tech that's not invented yet. And just, you know, seeing how they like fiddle their way through things and get it going.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people like us for whom one of their favorite movie scenes in history is the Apollo 13. We need to turn this into this using that.
Yes, I remember that scene. Yeah. The Martian, and I don't like to cuss, so I can't say it all completely in case my mom's watching. But we need to science the crap out of this.
Yep, exactly.
Like, oh my goodness, I'm always impressed with this. I'm not stupid. But I also know that if I was in that situation, these guys who know how to do that type of stuff is like, I'm just always impressed to have that all. Because again, like for instance, in the case of the Martian, he's got that all in his head. He doesn't have reference material for the most part. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Now we're getting off topic. Oh my goodness. There were so many things I liked about this book. There's so many things I can't ask you without spoiling stuff though. I also love the fact without going into detail, is I think you also have, this is not just a sci-fi book, but I think it's also to a certain extent philosophical on some things without getting too deep into certain questions. You know, I mean, obviously the big one is like, you know, the where did we come from, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But you also ask a few other philosophical questions, which I enjoyed, that I don't feel like I can actually say out loud without giving something away.
Well, I guess I can segue a little there, but I'm a big Philip K. Dick fan, despite the fact that, you know, I'm a pretty left-brain engineer type, and you know, my books all make rational sense, and relatively few of PKD's books actually make sense when you look at them in the final analysis, but they're great nonetheless, and the short stories even more so. But he was always hammering kind of the same question, what is human, right? And that's definitely one of the ones that's on my agenda with Exodelic too.
And I think you'll know what part I'm talking about, but I also think there was a little part that reminded me just a hair of like Man in the High Castle.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like that whole thing is like, it was giving me very much those vibes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So basically what I'm telling anybody is no matter what type of science fiction you like, you're going to find at least part of that in this book at some point.
PKD actually used to live not far from where I am in Berkeley, and one of my favorite anecdotes in science fiction history is that he and Ursula Le Guin went to the same high school at the same time and never met. Huh? It's a very large high school, and they became friends later in life, but still.
I can see that, though, especially because you think about some of the people that have those type of ties, and, you know, it's especially, you know, like a big high school like that, if you're not running in the same circles... Yep. I always think it's funny how big and how small the world is at the same time. Because, for instance, my ex, I was best friends with one of her best friends, but they went to we were different high schools. Never met them until after I started dating her. But then on the other hand, I ran into a friend from high school one time. We're both from Arizona. Ran into him in the middle of Disneyland. I mean, what are the chances that we both be in California at the same time, in the same spot, in the middle of Disneyland, and just like, hey, how's it going?
I mean, this is also a segue to the book to some extent, right? Because I think we've all had the one where we're like, are there really only 1,000 people in this world and our encounters being scripted or something? Because this seems like a real coincidence. You know, everyone you'll ever talk to will have one or two stories. Like, and there I was, and out of the blue,
And it happens more than you think. I ran into a coworker in the middle of the Denver airport one time. No idea we were both there. Yep. I had my brother-in-law found out we were both staying at the Waldorf Astoria on the same weekend. Again, they're also from Nebraska like we are. Had no idea we were both in New York the same weekend, much less staying in the same hotel. So I think that's probably too one of the things that ties us to that type of story that you're talking about is the fact that as ridiculous as it sounds, I think almost all of us have had those type of experiences.
Yes.
Yep. So life is a funny thing sometimes. So do you see, and I know we're talking about the fact that the paperback has just dropped for this book, but I don't feel like this book sets itself up for a sequel or anything, but do you see yourself getting, you know, dipping into that sci-fi section again, or are you already working on something?
I agree. The book is not a natural fit for a sequel. Like I could sort of vaguely envision one if forced, but when you try and fit everything in the kitchen sink into one book, it's sort of hard to imagine what else would go into the second book. I think I probably will dig into the science fiction corner of the closet again at some point. I'm not really sure when. My last couple of books, I wrote Exodelic being one and my Very Strange Squirrel book, you know, almost a decade beforehand. I wrote essentially because I realized that the idea had invaded my mind. It had sort of gotten its tentacles in there and was not going to get out unless I managed to sort of exercise it onto paper one way or another. So I expect that to happen again. I don't know what the idea will be. I don't know when that will happen, but it seems to be a thing that recurs.
Yeah, you've got to wait for that next earworm to take place.
Exactly.
All right. I do. And the other thing, don't take this wrong. I don't think I've ever told an author about this. I don't want you to write a sequel to Exodelic because I think your final chapter was the perfect wrap up to that story.
I appreciate that. The final chapter, I think some people didn't get it, which is fine. It is not a book made to be gotten by everyone. But I also am very, very pleased with the final chapter. You know, there were other potential endings that I discussed with my agent and editor at one point, but I'm very, very happy with what I landed on.
Yeah, that one was the perfect one.
Yeah.
And unless I'm a complete and utter idiot, I'm really, really sure I got it. But I ain't going to say it. Maybe once we go off the air, I'll double check with you. But yeah, I'm 99.9% sure I got it. Oh my goodness. Like I said, the fact that your book changes so much from beginning to end makes it very, very hard not to get too spoilery about it.
So my rule of thumb is that spoiling the first act of the book is fine, the first 20%. And there's actually a lot of spoiling there. So if I do it, I have to say, so, you know, it sounds like I revealed absolutely everything about the book, but we're actually only a fifth of the way through.
Yeah. And again, because, yeah, you are. I mean, in fact, you was in five parts, as I recollect as well. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that first part, like I said, that first part, you're very much going in for anybody who has seen the movie Eagle Eye or watched the TV show Person of Interest. It's very much that vibe. But then we, like I said, you throw the kitchen sink at it. You get a little bit of Neo going on. You get a little bit of... and there's a lot of stuff in there that I won't explain how we get to from one to the other, but
yeah, you're not supposed to quote your own lines, but there's one I'm fond of near the end of the first act, which is someone, I think Meredith says, the situation has escalated far beyond anything we ever even imagined possible, which I think without spoilers gives you a pretty good sense of what is going on at that particular confluence.
Yeah. So, that's one of the things too, like the fact that again, science fiction usually tries to be a little science accurate. For the most part.
Yep.
And the one thing that was throwing me off in that first act was the whole immunity to bullets thing. But by the second or third act, you're like, duh. Of course that makes sense now.
Yes.
So anybody who picks up this book and is a little bit lost in the first chapter, don't worry. You will get all your answers. They will get there.
There's a Donald Rumsfeld line, if a problem cannot be solved, enlarge it. That's sort of the approach to the book. There's, we enlarge the scope. We enter the questions of the previous section by enlarging the scope and making those questions seem almost irrelevant, you know, obvious, in fact, now that you have this new perspective.
This is a side question. I'm going to throw this one. This one might be coming from left field, but there's a character in the book. And again, I was listening to the audio. So I think it's Liz. And I just want to ask, who hurt you?
Ironically, she is very, very loosely based in a good friend of mine, like an evil version of a good friend of mine. But actually, one of my lines about how to create villains is that, you know, creating, you know, evil villains that are very boring is quite easy. The most interesting villains by far, and this is a cheat sheet to get away to an interesting villain, is take your friends and then imagine them gone pure, pure evil.
Like, you've removed all the social strictures or everything. I have to say, for a minute there, I thought you were going to say she was loosely based on an ex, but yeah. Loosely based on your friend. I hope your friend never figures out who she's based on. That's all I got to say about that.
Actually, her book club was at one point going to read the book, who I was informed. Then I got no further updates on that. So I've decided to leave that, you know, that particular loose thread unpulled.
I'm just going to say this. I know that there's probably going to be a few people who love Liz. And the rest of us are scared crapless. I do not want to meet that woman ever. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. She was different.
She has a couple good lines, though.
She's a great villain, though. Yeah. She's a great villain. Don't get me wrong. In fact, she made that. Who was the third guy? I think he did that on purpose, though, because there was the I can't remember names if I listen to the audiobook. It's the only downside for me in the audiobook. You get the main bad guy.
They're sort of a triad of villains.
Yes. And I think you did the third one. He is almost boring.
Yes.
But I think he's there to, like, even out the other two. Because the other two, yeah, you got full-on Bond villains going on there. And then there's just this guy from accounting or something who's just like, I'm just here for the money. I just want to see what happens.
Well, I mean, that's true. And I also thought it was kind of funny. Like, you can't have everyone be a super interesting. There is always the guy from accounting. So.
Well, and two, I think you actually said that. I do remember parts of, you know, listening to it. But I think he actually has a thing or no. The protagonist was talking about the fact that this was the guy who would do anything to know why. He wasn't there for the power. He wasn't there for the money. He was there to understand.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that was kind of the fun too, is the fact that all three of your villains had different motivations. And I think that's probably the only reason they could work together.
Yeah, very much.
Because none of them were fighting for the top spot.
Right. You can't have three people all trying to be, you know, the dictator working as a junta. So.
Yeah. The Sinister Six doesn't always work out.
Yes. Yeah.
You had so many good parts in this book, and I was just like, I have to pick them out piece in piece because I definitely don't want to give out the natural order of things. But again, too, the fact that, as you said, he keeps running into people and every time he runs into them, they're not necessarily the people he remembers. And that's all I'm going to say about that, which is if you're in that situation, that's got to screw with your head.
Yes. It's also, as a writer, it's a kind of a fun way to build character. Like, if you get different perspectives on different perceptions, shall we say, or different angles on the same person, then it's a good way to describe, you know, who they are internally and who they are because of their surroundings. And I think, that's an interesting way to look at almost anyone, you know, whether fictional character or real.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of times, you know, like, who would you be if you'd grown up in a different situation?
Yeah. And there are a couple of, like, there's one angle from which Meredith is the hero who's saving the world early on. And by the end of the book, there's a very different angle. Like, you kind of reinterpret her in light of all of that.
And again, it's one of those things, is like, this is what she is in this situation. But if you throw a different situation at her, but I mean, we're all like that.
Yeah.
That extreme, but to an extent, it's like they always say, there's the work you and then there's the home you. Right. You act different depending on a lot of times what the expectation is.
And there's also the power gradient, right? Like Lord Acton said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. I'm not sure that's true. You know, I don't think, but I do think there's definitely a correlation. And I do think if you give most people a lot of power, they wouldn't maybe behave at their absolute best if it was given to them. I mean, looking around in the world, the news today, we see a lot of that happening. So.
Yeah, the less you have to worry about consequences, I think the more you see of what a person is.
And the more you can convince yourself that what you're working on is the most important thing in the world, and therefore everything else is secondary and expendable. Then,
So I just have a feeling that you, especially by the time you get to the end of this book, you just had so much fun writing it.
Absolutely. Yes. It was a ball.
I can only imagine your editor going through it, though. I was like, wait, what? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the copy edit was I had a know, I don't think it was physically scratched out, but it's pretty apparent there were a couple of sections where like, this is a clearly wrong formatting and textual error, followed by, oh, this is not a clearly wrong formatting and textual error. Never mind. Let me just step this over for the whoever winds up typesetting this thing.
All right. Oh, crud. I don't have that on this one. I was trying to give, I did want to give credit. I can't remember who the voice actor was. And I thought I had it on my phone, but I was playing it in something else.
I can very quickly type up, I think. But yeah, that was, I thought he was great too.
Well, he did a great job.
Yeah. I got a few options. And the first choice was, who I'm sure you know is a fine actor, Brian Hutchison. That's it.
Okay,
the first
choice,
who I'm sure is a fine voice, just didn't work for me, and they sort of reluctantly gave me a few other options. I was like, one of these is clearly better than the others. I don't know how you even have mentioned the others. Yeah, he was great.
So yeah, he knocked it out of the park. I'm always impressed too with somebody, especially like right now, my voice is kind of crap right now, but like in the morning, I've got kind of like that morning DJ voice going on.
Right.
And so I could definitely, people tell me I could do stuff like that, but it's like, no, I can't do female voices. That's just not happening. And trying to keep straight 8 different characters and remember to use the right tone and accent on each one. I'm always impressed with some of these voice actors. Delaney Nicole Gill's another one was absolutely, she knocked out, she did Incidents Around the House. By Josh Mellerman. Just, I'm like, so impressed. It's like so much talent there.
Honestly, it's hard writing just a scene with 8 people talking. Like, just writing that is difficult from a technical point of view. Like, making sure that, you know, no one's monopolizing it and making sure it's clear who's speaking at any given moment. Actually doing it as a single voice with, like, 8 different...
I got to get one on here sometime. I just want to know, like, do they just sit there and read through the book and jump back and forth? Or do they like have a special type of book, depending on who it is? Like, we're going to do all of this voice first so I can keep it straight. And then I'm going to do all of this voice and we'll just put it together later. Cause, oh, it's just crazy. But yeah, I think they definitely helped push the story along. I've had a few where I've listened to the voice actor in a book and I almost feel like I wished I'd read this instead because I don't like the way they did it. But yeah. The audiobook, for anybody who likes audiobooks, this one was excellent. Loved the voice actor on it.
As a funny aside, the head of audiobooks gave me a call because there's a bunch of weird words or unusual words in Exodelic. Exodelic being one of them, obviously.
That's what I'm saying.
To check on pronunciations. And I used the word Ansible, and he mentions early on that he published Ursula Le Guin and did a haul for audiobooks and then said Ansible. I was like, it's a Le Guin word. I think you should probably take the responsibility for how this one's pronounced. I don't actually know. Like, you pass it on. Yeah,
so. Well, again, I think that's another thing too with the audiobook. Because again, I finished up. I started reading it, listened to it in the middle, and I finished up reading it. So I think it also helps too if you get somebody who can do that. Because now I'm like, oh, that's how that would have been pronounced. Because I don't know if I would have read it that way.
Yeah.
What was it? The Ozzy, I think it was. I mean, that was not spelled the way I thought it was when he was saying it.
Right, that was another SF reference. That's C.J. Cherry from Citeen and a couple of other books, The Aussie.
Oh, look at you. You just like, there just needs to be a thing. Was like, okay, we're going to have the John Evans Book Club, and it's just going to be all the books that he read that formed his opinion on things.
The Utopians group are actually Ada Palmer's Terra Ignota Utopians, or, you know, loosely serial numbers filed off version of them. Yeah, there are a bunch of references scattered through this one. So.
And I think a lot of that you mentioned too in the acknowledgments, I don't think I quite finished going through all the acknowledgments. I always go through all the prologues and the epilogues. I don't always hit all the acknowledgments, I admit it.
Honestly, I don't either. But, you know, it's nice for people who are in there. So.
Exactly. All right. So I think we've talked about all we can talk about on the book without spoiling the book, because I don't want to spoil the book. So let me just wrap up with a few other types of questions. What is John Evans reading right now? If we can talk about him in the third person.
John Evans just finished this kind of great book called The Maniac, which is about John von Neumann. John von Neumann? I don't know how to pronounce that name. The great mathematician of the 20th century. But also about modern AI and the AlphaGo tournament. And about how von Neumann invented cellular automata, which turns up in Exodelic, or at least was significant, and game theory, and artificial intelligence, and software being. So it's a pretty... You know, it's a nice add-on to all the themes in Exodelic. It's a very good book written by a Chilean author. Benjamin Larabut.
I do like to read a good downside is a lot of those times it all depends on who does the translation on whether how well the book turns out.
So I think he read it in English. I didn't see a translation.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Maybe he's a Joseph Conrad type who, you know, Conrad learned English in his late 20s and became one of the great stylists in the language, which is insane. But yeah.
I feel like people who study this and it's not their normal one probably pay more attention than those of us who spend 12 years and still can't spell loose by the time they get out of high school.
That's probably true. Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day, like, I don't know what grammar rule you've just broken. I know you've broken one, but I have no actual idea how the rules of grammar work in English. I just know how to do them.
I'm usually decent with everything, except for I'll be the first one to say is like, I have no idea what to do with this semicolon. I know what it's for. I never know when I should use it.
I know what it's for. It's for massively overusing them and then going back and taking them out because you realize there's eight on every given page, which that's my approach.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mine is parentheses. I use way too many parentheses, and I know that. I'm just admitting it now. Anybody who likes Exodelic, what do you think they should read as well?
I think they could do a lot worse than to read Terra Ignota by Ada Palmer, who I mentioned earlier. And also the Just Cities series by Joe Walton. They're similarly sort of everything in the kitchen sink. Oh, right. The Just City is so the basic concept is that the Greek gods decide to get a bunch of historical figures and also future figures and also a robot together, throw them back in time to an island and create Plato's The Republic. That's offstage before the book actually begins, and it gets weirder from there. And later on in the series, aliens turn up. So it's another very, very much everything in the kitchen sink, but it's very thoughtful and philosophical, and unlike Exodelic, the books are quite short. So.
And as a bit of a segue there, and I won't tell anybody what this means, but you'll know what it means. I also saw your love of the Greek gods in Exodelic as well, and that's all I'm going to say about that.
I appreciate that, yes.
One of the questions I like to ask people, and I take this all the way back to Elise Stevens because she brought up something that I would have never thought to ask. Is there a fact or hobby or skill that you have outside of writing that you wish more people knew about?
That's an interesting question. I think I'm pretty upfront about things like travel and software and the other things that I work on. Nothing that leaps to mind. I feel like since I have a Substack, I'm kind of blatantly open about these things. And perhaps, if anything, I'm erring on the side of oversharing already.
So. Gotcha. Yeah, no worries. Yeah. And then the other one I like to ask, and then I've got two more to finish up. Is there anything that you were hoping that would be brought up or thought I might bring up that you did not get to answer?
Actually, I'll retroactively answer the last question and possibly this question. I've grown mildly obsessed with the Gnostics of the first couple of centuries AD. And I maintain that there's a straight line connection from the Gnostics to modern science fiction. But I don't think of time for me to unpack that.
Your reading homework is the Gospel of Thomas.
Yes, right, exactly. Yes. I guess it's worth mentioning, I just started a new job, which is entertainingly science fiction, so I'll mention that. I'm working at a company that is using AI to research and forecast the future of AI. So if there's a more science fictional job out there, I'm sure they exist, but there can't be that many more.
That almost seems like an AI that made a job for itself. All right. I do think, though, that should be your next science fiction foray, although it might be a little too Exodelic-ish, you could write a story about that time capsule AI you've got going up there and how while it's just sitting around, it's becoming sentient. Somebody goes to open the time capsule and they just opened up a can of worms. All right. Last two questions I always like to ask. Oh my goodness, I just brain dumped on one, so I'll go to the other one.
Oh, I have a reference. That's sort of how I fire up on the deep begins.
Oh, okay, nice.
Yeah, there's Vera Vinge. Who is, you know, Vinge is one of the most seminal science fiction writers of our era. And that's one of the ways, yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. And then I always ask everybody to give a shout out to a brick and mortar store, bookstore of their choice.
All right. I am going to shout out to Borderlands Books in San Francisco. It's an obvious choice, but it's an obvious one for very good reasons. So Borderlands is great.
Yeah, I think I've only had one other author mention that, and that was another California author. But usually I hear is it Galaxies, things that, or is that San Diego?
Oh, Mysterious Galaxies. Yeah, that's San Diego.
Yeah, Mysterious Galaxies is the one. Yeah. You do enough of these, you start hearing some of the same bookstores over and over
right,
again.
All the Minnesota writers are Uncle Hugo's.
I forgot about your slightly Canadian there until I heard you say about.
I guess while I'm Canadian, also Backup Books in Toronto is the other one.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Toronto.
Backup Phoenix.
I think Ian Rogers, I think, is from Toronto. Horror author. Okay, now I got to look something up. It's driving me crazy. I know that there's one other question I usually like to ask, and for once, I am completely brain dumping, and I don't know why I'm completely brain dumping on this. Let's see. I was trying to see if I had. Sometimes I have a copy of like my questions, and I did not have it ready this time. And if this wasn't live, I could always just edit this out later. But instead, people get to see me flail around. So
I think people like seeing the little dog ears and the little infelicities. They, you know, it reminds them that we're actual human beings. We are absolutely not artificial intelligence. I just want to make that very, very clear. Even if we only appear to as video on your computer screen.
Oh, you know what? And I think the reason I forgot it is because I think we already touched on it. Usually, I ask what you're working on now, and it didn't seem like you. Thanks.
Yep. I have some ideas I'm toying with.
Thanks, Brad.
Yeah.
And apparently my mother is blaming it on me going on vacation. I've got vacation brain going on. I just got back Sunday, so.
There's that William Gibson thing where like your body returns home, but your soul takes a few more days to fly through the air. Maybe that's what's happening.
I can tell you my wants want to stay in that 80 degree weather. It's like, it's 9 degrees right now where I'm at. It's like, this is not fun.
There's a reason I exiled myself from Canada to California, right?
So. Yep, nope, yeah. I get that. Yeah, that trust me, that I think that was a good choice. I got a couple of guys I like up there. Who's the other one? Sylvain Nouvel is also from Canada, and I love those guys. But man, I couldn't live up there. I'm not built for that weather.
Montreal is my favorite city, but Montreal winters were too much for me. I tried it for a couple of years, too much. Yeah.
So. Gotcha. All right. Well, I think that is it. Obviously, some people are watching, but nobody seemed to have any questions. So I want to thank you for hopping on this. I do appreciate that. And next time you've got a book coming out, I'm going to have to you're going to have to let me know when the next one coming down the pipe.
I will keep you posted. Thank you kindly, Edward.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for watching, and we will catch you later.
Thanks, all.